You're listening to Delve Talks, a podcast that digs into the challenges around design, product development, leadership, and innovation. Our first season focuses on what it takes to create a corporate culture that supports innovation. Your host, Dave Franchino, is the president of Delve, a design and innovation consultancy.
Hi, my name is Dave Franchino, and I am the host of Delve Talks, a podcast focused on creating a culture of innovation. And I'm really excited. Today, my guest is Will Biederman. Will's the head of emerging projects for Verily Life Sciences. And if you don't recognize Verily, you're probably going to recognize the family tree, formerly known, if I'm correct, as Google Life Sciences, which was a division of Google X. Verily is Alphabet's research organization devoted to the study of life sciences. And Will, I did just a bit of searching before this conversation. I found your name on over 25 issued patents, hundreds of citations, and more than a half dozen or so pending applications. So clearly a pretty strong personal focus and pedigree on innovation. Really excited to have you join us. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you very much, Dave. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Great. Well, maybe you could start by telling our listeners just a little bit about your background. Just describe kind of your pedigree and how you came to your current role. And I think that'll provide some nice context for the rest of the discussion.
Absolutely. Sounds good. I think I'll start by telling you a little bit about myself and then transition into my journey and how that led to where I am now. So I guess as a child and historically, I was always really interested in two areas, health and electronics. And so growing up, I wanted to be a doctor. I was fascinated by medicine. I wasn't grossed out by blood and guts. But at the same time, I also would like to take apart things in the house, build devices, build computers at home, super curious mindset. So going into college, I had to make a decision between medicine, pre-med, and engineering. And it really kind of tore me up for a while. Ultimately, I chose to take an engineering path and resolved to apply myself to health and medical problems. So I studied electrical engineering, and after doing some internships and doing a bunch of research in undergrad in the health and medical space, I decided to pursue a PhD so I could ultimately research more novel health applications of electronics. So from academia, I was actually directly recruited into Google X after a presentation I was making at a research conference. And so I've been at Google X and then subsequently Google Life Science, as you mentioned, the transition there, which has been rebranded to Verily after the Alphabet restructuring. So I've been there for the past 7 years, mostly focused on developing novel devices for diabetes and other miniaturized biosensors. And now I lead the emerging projects team at Verily, where we focus on developing the next pipeline of device projects and partnerships.
Well, I was really struck by something you said in that your sort of personal journey and debate as to whether or not you wanted to pursue a career in medicine or a career as an engineer. I really think that the intersection between health and innovation is almost the perfect frontier for innovation. But one of the things that makes that so challenging, I think, is that they tend to be two kind of wildly divergent tracks. You know, it takes so much effort to become a physician, MD, or so much effort to become an engineer that you don't often find people that can seamlessly cross both paths. What would you say to that? What have you learned about the similarities between the mindsets that it takes to perhaps be a practitioner, a clinical individual, an innovator, and how can we help drive innovation to be a little bit more seamless across that really important frontier?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And it really kind of speaks to the healthcare industry as a whole, where it's not just kind of a health-focused industry anymore. It's really pulling multiple disciplines in to solve some of these bigger problems. And I think it's actually a really interesting time for healthcare, because there's an increasing national attention on health and a shift in focus from reactive to proactive care for people. And what this really means is a shift from treating the symptoms of a disease to treating the underlying cause or even preventing the disease itself. And so, of course, as you might imagine, these are typically huge multifaceted problems that require many new disciplines, require EEs, MEs, software engineers. And it's not just some new app that's going to solve a problem, or some new wearable, or some new fangled sensor. But it's a focus on comprehensive disease management platforms. And maybe a kind of a good example of this to illustrate it for the listeners is diabetes. Diabetes is a large and growing worldwide problem that's affecting over 400 million people, which consists of prediabetes, type 2 diabetes, and type 1 diabetes. And without proper management, many of these people progress from prediabetes to type 2 diabetes, or the severity of their type 2 diabetes worsens. And so historically, the approach has been very reactive, treating the symptoms as the disease progresses. But now, more recently, there's been a push by several companies, including Verily, to create these type 2 diabetes management platforms, which are really virtual care platforms that are pulling in personalized treatments that includes like custom devices, custom delivery mechanisms for insulin, coaching, clinical support. All these different disciplines are really coming together to address sort of the root cause and provide more proactive care.
Interesting. Well, maybe to step on a topic that's completely different, I noticed that you, with a deeply technical PhD, I'm assuming you gave some thought to a career in academics. And maybe that's not true, but I was kind of curious if you did. Tell me about the process of deciding to work for a commercial organization, and maybe how you'd contrast the innovation process you saw in academia versus the process you've been exposed to or have tried to help foster within industry. How are they the same? How might they be different?
Yeah, so I certainly did debate between being a professor, staying in academia, and going into industry. I think for me, there are a lot of benefits that a larger organization provides. There's a lot more resources, a lot more connections that can be made throughout industry to get get ideas out into the market. And so when it comes to similarities and innovation, I think it comes down to a few things. So it's first the team, it's the group of people, it's the mindset. And in academia, people are very unconstrained by their sort of lack of experience. And so the sky's the limit. But you can also build this creative team in industry as well. So you kind of have to start an industry by hiring a really great team, looking for really smart and creative people. And kind of to speak to that, don't be afraid to hire people smarter than you. But kind of secondly, it's a culture. And in academia, people are focused on doing research and doing things that haven't been done before. Building that culture in industry is very important.
I noticed in looking and preparing for this, I looked at the background of Astro Teller, who I believe is the leader of the Google X, or X, I think it's called now that you're under. And I noticed his background is listed as entrepreneur scientist, which is, I think, a background that could describe your background as well. So you work for a commercial organization, but you have a deeply scientific background. What advantages do you think that deeply scientific background brings to your current role? I would assume that you deal with a lot of the same issues that a lot of managers deal with, but you come to that with kind of a unique benefit of having a deep academic and scientific background.
Yeah, I think spending a lot of time in academia really helped me kind of focus on thinking a little bit bigger. That's kind of one of the biggest challenges that I think people suffer from when thinking about innovation, is actually not thinking big enough. And kind of speaking to Google X's culture, it's almost cliche at this point, but people frequently focus on incremental improvements rather than 10x improvements. And I think actually Astro gives this analogy pretty frequently. But, if you tell an automotive engineering team to improve the fuel efficiency of a car from 40 to 50 miles per gallon, they may tackle a problem by trying to squeeze out some optimizations from the engine, or, improving the manufacturing line slightly to eke out that, small incremental improvement. But then if you tell them to improve the fuel efficiency from 40 miles per gallon to 500 miles per gallon, then you have to completely rethink the problem and the challenge and challenge old assumptions. So you have to go back to first principles, and that's where that scientific kind of an engineering background kind of takes you back to these first principles and challenging the assumptions from the last generation, which may not be true anymore because of technological advances. So even if this team ends up falling short of the 500 mile per gallon, you know, goal, in the process of trying, they've innovated and they could end up doing a lot better than the 50 mile per gallon.
I think that's really brilliantly stated. I appreciate that. Let me build on that for a second. I think there's a lot of our listeners that might right now be listening to this and thinking, yeah, that's great, but Google has an unfair advantage when pursuing this type of innovation. But I'm guessing that many of them probably may have more assets and more opportunities than they realize, and some of their constraints are more self-imposed. What would you say to the leader who feels kind of they're hamstrung by circumstances and not able to be as innovative as they'd like?
Yeah, so I think I would probably tell them to focus on three things. So first, make sure you have the right team in place, and you know, independent of, you know, compensation, benefits, et cetera, that Google can provide and maybe feels like an unfair advantage to some startups. Like, these startups can still attract talent through a strong mission. So attract the talent, make sure you have the right team in place, surround yourself with people with different sets of experiences and skill sets who are really passionate about building amazing products. I think this is really step one of innovation, is having the people. Then, you know, make sure these people are supported and empowered. That is essentially directly comes from leadership. So make sure your team feels psychologically safe to fail, because then when you innovate, you're inevitably going to fail, but then you can iterate until you're successful. So it's not just, you know, fail fast. I think in Silicon Valley, you hear that cliche a lot. It's, you know, fail fast, but it's fail fast and then iterate and prototype your way forward. So the path to success is filled with, you know, experimentation. And then probably the third thing is maintain your focus on your user, your customer, the patient, and everything else will kind of come to fruition after that. So build products that are useful and relevant, and provide new solutions for old problems, or find new problems that no one sees yet.
I think that's really nicely articulated. I hope our listeners take that to heart. Will, in this conversation, a couple of times you've talked about managing and motivating your team. Just kind of a personal question, how has the transition been from sort of being personally innovative to managing teams and individuals underneath you that are doing innovation? I'm sure you continue to innovate. Obviously, your patent track record speaks for itself, but I would assume that part of your responsibility now is less about kind of being on the front line of that innovation, more about motivating teams of individuals who report to you to be innovative. How have you found that transition to be? What have your lessons been?
Yeah, so I found it to be pretty rewarding. And as you're calling out, it's definitely a shift in thinking and responsibilities into a leadership role. And really, I've find that my focus is on enabling and empowering the team to succeed. So building a mission that matters for the team, creating that unified vision, and helping the team kind of understand why it matters to them and why it matters to the patient or the customer. That's a big part of the role. And then kind of eliminating all the roadblocks to help them innovate, to help them move more quickly. And really making them feel kind of psychologically safe and create the culture and environment to help them succeed.
So what are your thoughts then on motivating, reward, and incentivizing innovation? You're obviously in a high-risk environment. There's an expectation of needing to pivot or fail or iterate. How do you incent and motivate and reward writ large innovation within your organization?
I think as you're calling out, you know, it's kind of like a shotgun approach where you're not looking for ideas, for every idea to exceed, but you're kind of looking for the one or two ideas that are going to be $1 billion ideas, that are really going to take off and make a big difference for the bottom line of your business. I mean, at the end of the day, the R&D units, innovation, et cetera, shouldn't be losing money. It should be generating future revenue for the company. And so you have to strike a balance between rewarding technical accomplishments and rewarding results rather than a specific success or failure of a project or idea. So just because a idea or concept doesn't make it to market or is proven unfeasible doesn't mean there wasn't really good technical work and really good output that the team got from pursuing that idea. So you have to kind of tease out the success of a project from the output of the team.
I understand. Maybe, Will, to build on that just a little bit, I know a lot of organizations experience tension between a desire to invest in kind of higher risk, high reward innovation efforts, and then a desire to kind of contribute to the frontline business. My sense is that Verily probably has the luxury of being able to take a slightly longer, maybe more strategic view than a lot of companies do. Maybe that's not the case. What have you learned about the opportunities and challenges associated with working on efforts that can contribute in the short term versus efforts that can contribute in kind of the longer term and maybe larger? How do you go about prioritizing your efforts on kind of short-term business success versus longer-term, more blue-sky innovation?
Yeah, I think probably similar to most companies out there, Verily kind of takes a portfolio approach to their projects. They have a kind of a spectrum of risk and a spectrum of timeline to bring these projects to fruition. Some of them are very near term, have been delivered, will be delivered soon. Others are very long term, high risk, but high reward opportunities. And so I think, so maintaining that balance from a business perspective, of course, is very, very important to a successful company. But I also think that kind of there's a little bit of a misconception out there that innovation is kind of only really the responsibility of one person, one group. But in my opinion, innovation should be everyone's responsibility. It doesn't really come from one place. So even though there's teams kind of, you know, grinding away at, you know, the final iteration of a design, getting ready to go for FDA submission or whatever it may be, like carving out some time, making sure that team has the ability to carve out some time to kind of think about the next sort of next version, the next thing, what the problems are for that the project they're working on that can be solved. And maybe one thing to highlight, which I'm a big fan of, is this concept that Google has called 20% time. And it's, for those that aren't aware of it, it's 20% time. It's time taken to work on something other than your primary project for up to 20% of your total work time. So this is a really important component of Google's culture. 20% time was developed to encourage innovation, specifically for this reason, in product development, foster inter-team communication, and enhance employee skills. And so all kind of engineering employees, regardless of job function, are encouraged by the highest levels, Larry Page, Sergey Brin, to think about 20% projects. And this is actually where some of Google's biggest products, Gmail, Maps, et cetera, have come from, while from these employees thinking about these other things while working on search or whatever the primary focus was at the time.
I really like a lot of what you said there, Will, and the idea that innovation is the responsibility throughout the entire organization is one that I think I firmly agree with. One thing that's interesting in these podcasts that I've been recording, Google is the second one of the companies that I've spoken to who's elected, at least to some extent, to intentionally segregate very high risk, very high reward innovation efforts out of the mainstream, I'll call it money-making part of the organization and business. And I'm curious if you have any advice for other business leaders at firms who might be considering whether or not to break off an arm of their organization to focus more specifically on higher risk, higher reward innovation versus trying to bake that innovation throughout an entire organization. What have you learned that might be able to provide some guidance to leaders of organizations who are trying to debate that within their own firms?
Yeah, I think, I don't want to opine too much on the reasons for Alphabet restructuring, but part of my understanding was out of kind of shareholder transparency and to spend for these different efforts, which of course is very important. I think when considering to segment out a kind of a branch for R&D and innovation, it could make sense for the company. Obviously it did for Alphabet, but I think it's also important to consider the cultural impacts it may have and how it could potentially stifle employees that are not in that division from feeling empowered to innovate. And ultimately, like, playing off of the 20% time concept, I think that, the next great idea could come from anywhere. It doesn't have to just come from one place. And so, if you do kind of branch off these innovation arms, as we'll call them, then making sure that they're not the only place that innovation can come from. Which is true in Google's case as well. They have Google X, they have the 120 Labs, they have Verily, but they still also do Google research as well. So it's not, they're not restricted. Like, the Google employees aren't just working on search. They are still actively doing 20% time, actively coming up with the next great thing for Google. It's just a different business unit.
You touched on this earlier, but I'd like to maybe ask you to dive into it a little bit deeper, a topic that's of great interest to me, and that's the concept of failure. It's intuitive that the higher the degree of risk, the higher the probability of failure, and our listeners can't see it, but I'll put failure in finger quotes there. My understanding is that Google famously seeks to celebrate failure. I'm sure the reality is nuanced relative to that. What thoughts do you have, Will, on the role of failure in helping drive innovation, and what have you learned that might be interesting in terms of helping understand the perspective you've gained on failure and how it helps drive innovation?
Yeah, I think I think failure is important, and I don't think I'd go as far to say that failure is celebrated at Google, but it's not feared either, and I think that's part of creating this culture of psychological safety for people to feel empowered to go out and try something new, try something different and risky. I think that failure is important because you can push the limits as long as you learn something from the failure. If you fail and don't learn and are not able to iterate, then the failure should not be rewarded, and it was not productive. So I think that's the key differentiation, is that it's not just failing to fail, it's failing to learn. As I mentioned earlier, you fail and you iterate and you experiment and you grow, and the path should never just end on a failure.
Great. Well, maybe one last question before we wrap it up, and that's, I'm curious, you've obviously gained a tremendous amount of experience in helping both drive innovation with your own personal efforts and then lead an innovative organization. What are the major pieces of advice you might give to somebody who wants their company to be more innovative, would like to try to find a way to build on perhaps some of the methods or tools or successes that you or Verily have been able to experience? What advice might you be able to give?
Yeah, so I think I'll probably focus on two things. The first is focus on your users or patients. It's very common for companies to focus on the competition or to focus on people's opinions in the boardroom or in the meeting room, et cetera. So really know the user, generate empathy within the team. Increasingly, researchers recognize that actively taking the perspective of others encourages employees to develop ideas that are useful as well as novel. So, with empathy, you can find inspiration and real human needs and motivations to invent. and innovate meaningful product and service solutions. So, you know, get out there, run the UX studies, get everyone hands-on with the customer, get the feedback about the product in the field. Like, get out there, get that data, make data-driven decisions that at the end of the day are focused on the user and patient. And then second, something that I don't hear talked about very often when it comes to culture, creating a culture of innovation, is about how to generate the trust required for that innovation. So set the stage for these big ideas by being transparent within the organization. Transparency in the workplace builds trust. And in my opinion, that trust is a prerequisite for innovation. So everyone should feel comfortable expressing themselves without the fear of being judged, ignored, or reprimanded. So that trust is kind of like at the very foundation of building a culture of innovation. And all of this can be done from leadership at the top.
Well, it's very impressive, and to be candid, very inspiring as well. So I really appreciate your comments. It's been fantastic of you to come on, share a little bit about yourself and your background, and then talk a little bit about some of the innovation efforts within Verily that I know our listeners will be fascinated to hear about. Once again, to my guest was Will Biederman. Will is the head of emerging products for Verily Life Sciences. Will, I really appreciate your time and your thoughts. I know our listeners are really going to enjoy this podcast.
Well, thank you very much, Dave. It's been a pleasure joining you today.
Thanks much.
But what that does is it makes me think,